Are you seeking insights into the future of vaccines and global health? Then join me for a compelling conversation with an industry expert.
And our mission is to discover, develop, and deliver safe, affordable, and infectious vaccines.
In this episode of the Beginner's Mind podcast, I welcome Colin McCann from the International Vaccine Institute. Together, we delve into vaccine accessibility, cutting-edge technologies, and the power of collaboration in shaping global health.
It's a win-win situation. If we are able to develop the capacity for one country to manufacture vaccines and another to...
In today's episode, we cover topics like uncovering the significance of vaccine accessibility and distribution in emerging markets, exploring the potential of mRNA vaccines and other groundbreaking technologies, gaining insights into how partnerships between countries and organizations can drive global health advancements.
There is a system in place, the IVI approach, for example, of developing a vaccine from evidence through licensure and delivery. It's there, it works. It's a proven model.
Enjoy the show and be sure to subscribe to the channel for more thought-provoking conversations.
Well, welcome everybody who's live. I'm happy to answer any questions later in the podcast.
So I hope the live stream works. Let me just check. Yeah, now It's on LinkedIn. This is always a great thing to see. I think I had one live stream where I forgot. What I learned with LinkedIn for the technical part is that I have to renew on the live streaming platform the token every 4 to 6 weeks. And one time I forgot it, and unfortunately the live stream was not live streamed.
You didn't know until afterwards.
Yeah, we live, we learn, I guess.
That's right. That's the challenges of technology.
Pauline, how is your time been in Vienna since we last met at our delicious dinner at Gagelis?
Yeah, I got to tell you, that was one of the best steaks I've had in a long time. So I really appreciated that dinner. Yeah, we've been pretty busy. Actually, the day of our dinner, Austrian Parliament approved the seat agreement, which grants IVI its international organization status here in Austria. I wasn't aware of that fact during the dinner. There wasn't a press release until the next morning. But in preparation for that, the last week or so has been busy doing all the logistical and bureaucratic arrangements for that, filing paperwork and making contacts. One good note is our board of trustees, sort of governance council for IVI, is coming to Austria in the beginning of May, and they'll be having their annual get together here, and we'll be interfacing with quite a number of government officials, the foreign ministry, the health ministry, the science ministry, and engaging with some of the local biotech firms as well on the sidelines.
That's great. How many people will be in Vienna?
What do you think? I think I saw between 25 and 30 people are coming.
Yeah, that's great. Now Vienna is a great place to meet internationally.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it.
Maybe we give a little bit background to what you do at the beginning, so to frame the episode so that people know what we are talking about.
Sure.
I have to say, before I saw you on the on LinkedIn popping up, I think it was a post from Lisa Vienna, if I remember it right, or AWS. I was not aware what IVI is. Can you please give a little bit of information on IVI for the listeners and a bit of information on your personal background?
Sure. So I'll start with kind of a basic summary of what IVI is. IVI is an international organization. It was established at the United Nations Development Program through a treaty called the Establishment Agreement of the International Vaccine Institute. That treaty has been signed by 39 countries and the World Health Organization. Part of my job is to get more countries to sign on to that treaty and to build the organization. And our mission is to discover, develop, and deliver safe, affordable, and infectious vaccines for use in global public health. And that's specifically vaccines for diseases that have endemic burden in low and middle income countries, for which there are little to no incentives in the pharmaceutical industry in the market to develop those vaccines. So we work across the vaccine development spectrum to advance the development of those vaccines. And I can get into that process a little more later. Our headquarters is in Seoul, South Korea, and we've been located there since 1997. And I can get into why we ended up there and how. We have around 230, 240 staff, primarily at our headquarters in Seoul, but now working across Asia, Africa, and Latin America. We have our new European regional office based in Stockholm, Sweden, and this new IVI country office located in Vienna, Austria. We also have three collaborating centers in Africa, in Ghana, and Ethiopia, and Madagascar. And those sites help us advance vaccine R&D programs in country.
What is your personal background? How did you get involved into IVI?
Sure. It's a long roundabout story, which I'll save the most of it. But, you know,
we have a lot of time today.
Sure. So I'm 39 years old, and the last 20 years, I've been traveling the world. I'm from the United States, the Midwest, a city called Cincinnati, Ohio, in the state of Ohio. And it's a nice place, but somewhat insular. And I had the itch to get out and see the world. So from the age of 19, I started traveling the world and seeing the world. And since then, I've been working and studying overseas for the greater part of 20 years. I graduated from university in 2008 in the U.S. in the midst of the global recession. Couldn't find a job. And like many Americans, I had a lot of student loans I had to pay back for the college program. And I only found three jobs available. There was a job in Costa Rica, in Algeria, or South Korea. And I took South Korea as a teaching job. So I stayed in South Korea for a couple of years. And while I was there, I met my now wife, but got bored of teaching and wanted to get my hands dirty. So I moved back to the U.S. And went to California and retrained as a wind turbine engineer. And one of the nice things about being in Austria is seeing all the wind turbines developing wind energy. And my goal is to be an engineer technician on those to help with maintaining and repairing those. One of my contacts in Korea was a Indian businessman based in Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. And he said, "Colin, there's a new program to build a wind farm in the United Arab Emirates. And I can get you connected into that. And there might be some great job opportunities to work in there." So I said, "You know, that's a great idea. That would be a lot more fun than working on a wind farm in Iowa or Nebraska in the middle of nowhere in the US." So as I'd done many times before, I packed a small suitcase and I bought a one-way ticket to Abu Dhabi and tried to see what I could do there. I found a place to live. I reconnected with my local contact and met with the local firm, which was supposed to lead this wind farm. And I was talking with them and found out that they had decided to cancel the wind farm without publicly notifying anybody.
Yeah.
And instead, they were going to reinvest the funding into buying a wind farm in Denmark, to my understanding. So I was in Abu Dhabi, left on a lurch. But I had another friend who was there who was working at the U.S. Embassy. And he informed me that there were some job opportunities at the embassy. And I ended up applying to the embassy on a random hunch. I didn't expect to get the job. I had done my undergraduate in international relations. Mm-hmm. And of course, so I was naturally thrilled at the idea of working for an embassy. But I didn't have any expectations that I would land the job. But as it turns out, I did. And so for the next 5 years, I worked at the U.S. Embassy in Abu Dhabi on a very low level as an administrative assistant, a file clerk, helping out here and there in different sections and offices. And while I was there, I applied for the U.S. Foreign Service, which is the process to become a U.S. diplomat. And I was able to pass the test and pass the following series of exams. And I got on a waiting list. to join the Foreign Service called a register. It's basically a list of candidates who are available. But unfortunately, at that time, they instituted a hiring freeze. And so there's very little chance of getting off of that list. Similar with the teaching job, I started to get bored of working at the embassy. I sort of hit my limit of what I could learn and do. And talking with my estranged girlfriend in Korea, we decided to finally get married. And I decided to quit working at the embassy, and I moved to South Korea. So I packed up that suitcase and I moved back to Seoul after being away for a while. And shortly thereafter, that was in 2016, my wife and I got married. We've been together now 5 years. Thank you. Thank you.
Belated congratulations. So.
Thank you. Thank you. And so I settled down in Seoul, and I decided to take Korean classes at Seoul National University to help improve my Korean language ability, and so I could, you know, assimilate better in that society. And at the time, I was working all these odd jobs just to make ends meet. I did some English teaching work. I did some helping out HR departments in different companies with their interviews, and also working as a background actor in a lot of TV commercials. At the time, they were preparing for the Winter Olympics, and they needed some foreigners to appear in their promotional commercials. So I would show up in the backgrounds of the commercials, waving a British flag or Canadian flag.
Look at you from building wind farms or maintaining wind farms in the middle of nowhere in the US to a Korean film star.
Yeah. I think that's the modern experience of a lot of people in my generation of rapidly changing jobs and careers. Only I've done it on a global level. So as luck is in terms of how I got with IVI, I was at my Korean classes and I made a friend. Her name is Dr. Andrea Hasselbeck. She's from Germany and she's an epidemiologist with the International Vaccine Institute. And she and I were taking classes together, and in between classes during our breaks, we would chit chat, you know, talk office, compare experiences with work overseas. And those conversations with Andrea turned into a job opportunity. IVI had a lot of work going on, a lot of grant writing, a lot of research papers, and they needed some help with proofreading and editing. So I took that on as a side job and got my foot in the door at IVI as an editor and a writer. As luck would have it, maybe 6 months after that fact, IVI established a global affairs office to help facilitate its international partnerships and its diplomatic relations. Mm-hmm. And so I applied for that job, and it was very competitive, but I was able to land that job. And that's how I started at IVI.
Right. Yeah. Congratulations. It's an exciting story. I mean, it has everything. Adversity, overcoming adversity, long distance relationship, I guess, when I hear it right. Yeah. Your wife was in Korea while you were stuck in the United Arab Emirates. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we tried to do the long distance thing. I think we made up and broke up more times than I can count. Sometimes she would visit me, I would visit her. Mm-hmm. I don't advise long distance relationships for anyone. They're very challenging, but this one worked out.
But you're the best example that, how can I say it in English? Love prevails. So it's...
yeah, love prevails. Yeah, if you're stubborn enough or foolish.
No, I think it's love is always great. Love is always great. Let's get a little bit away from love, although it's a great topic to talk about. Mm-hmm. Dive deeper into IVI. It was in 1997, you mentioned that IVI was founded. Mm-hmm. Why? What was the reason? I have a pharma background. So, I mean, basically, vaccines are produced by the pharma industry. I helped developing a company that was a vaccine developer in Vienna, Austria, a couple of years ago. It was bought, I think, by MSD during the pandemic. And I always had the picture that the major problems that vaccines can solve have been solved already. Why was it necessary to found IVI in the 90s and maintain it up to 2023?
Sure. So the foundation of IVI, which happened in 1997, actually goes back a little further into the late 80s, early 90s, with the establishment of a predecessor organization called the Children's Vaccine Initiative. Now, the Children's Vaccine Initiative, or CVI, was established as a collaborative effort between the World Health Organization, the World Bank, the United Nations Development Program, and the Rockefeller Foundation, a U.S. philanthropic organization. And these organizations came together to form CVI to address a critical problem. The World Health Organization had set up the EPI standards, the Expanded Program on Immunizations, a list of standard vaccines that, you know, every child in every country should receive. And at the time on the EPI, you had measles, DTP, which is diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus. You had oral polio vaccine, as well as BCG, the childhood tuberculosis vaccine. And while countries were rolling that out, there were still a great lag in countries adopting the EPI vaccine list. And there was uptake problems, and we still had millions of children dying of vaccine-preventable diseases in Africa, and especially in Asia-Pacific region. So CVI was established to try to counter that by increasing vaccine uptake through the EPI system, and also developing new vaccines that were not included on EPI for infectious diseases of high burden in these developing countries. And these vaccines had not been developed by major pharmaceutical companies yet because there was no market incentive. We're talking diseases like cholera and typhoid, waterborne diarrheal diseases that are not really a problem in the West. So CVI worked for over a period of about 8 years addressing those problems. And what they found at the center of the problem was the lack of a mechanism to connect the entire, all the elements of vaccine development. And I think it's important to conceptualize the vaccine development process to have a full picture of what we need to develop vaccines. We start vaccines in the laboratory. Scientists and researchers are playing with antigens, playing with molecules, seeing what they can get to work, and developing a vaccine candidate, a vaccine prototype. And that happens all over the world, and that was happening. But a lot of those vaccine prototypes would sit on the shelf. They wouldn't move any further because of lack of funding or access to what's called the translational development process. And that's where we figure out how to scale up the manufacture of a vaccine candidate from something inside of a beaker to something at 10 liters or 50 liters, even 100 liters, so that you can mass produce that vaccine. And so that's another additional process that, again, was happening independently. You know, sometimes a vaccine would be developed, but it would never be, the process would not be developed. And then there was technology transfer questions. You know, once you develop a vaccine and the process development, you have to move it to a manufacturer who's qualified and licensed to manufacture that vaccine. Next up, you have to have clinical trials. You have to have your three phases of clinical trials to demonstrate safety and efficacy. And there are plenty of organizations that handle clinical trials, that process clinical trials, mm-hmm. but they do it on an ad hoc basis or on a per request basis. And outside of the actual vaccine development, then you have the government aspects. You have the licensure and the regulatory approval that's required by the host country government of the manufacturer, and as well as the country that receives the vaccine. These vaccines have to be licensed and regulated not only by individual countries, but also by World Health Organization through the pre-qualification process. Then you actually have the manufacturing process. You have to have a profitable, sustainable manufacturing process. And then on the uptake side, you have to have either a market or a government, which is purchasing those vaccines, taking them, building up stockpiles, and delivering them to their populations. And that all is informed by evidence. You have to have epidemiology. You have to have disease surveillance in the field to understand the true burden of diseases in host country populations. You also need economic studies to inform policymakers. You have to show the cost of illness. If you have an untreated disease amidst the population, what's the economic cost of that, as well as the humanitarian cost. And if you develop a vaccine and that country decides to buy that vaccine, what's the return on investment? How many lives are they saving? How is that contributing to the economy? How is that reducing DALYs? And then you need the vaccine efficacy studies to show that the vaccine can work in different regions of different populations. So to summarize, all those elements up until that time were disjointed. They were taking part piecemeal, ad hoc, and CVI tried to bridge all of those, to build up a system that could lead a vaccine through every one of those stages, through the development, through tech transfer, through manufacture, through regulatory approval. And they did make some progress. So I think by the time that CVI closed up in 1997, 1998, EPI attainment levels had gotten up to 80% in most countries. And so there was a lot to celebrate. But eventually the support for CVI ran out. But before it did, two other organizations were established that mirrored the work of CVI. The first one was IVI, which was established through the CVI Institute initiative in 1997. And the second was Gavi. And Gavi was also established by CVI in the year 2000. And you can see today, if you can compare IVI and Gavi, you can trace our roots back to that model. IVI is on the upstream of things, handling the vaccine R&D, the transfers, the manufacturing, whereas Gavi is on the downstream, trying to incentivize uptake and purchasing and delivery. And that's really where we came from. In terms of how IVI was established, they decided to establish us as an international organization to give us a greater sense of stature and independence that CVI was lacking. CVI was never really formalized as an organization. It was more of an alliance. But IVI as an institute, as an organization with backing from countries, would be able to fill the gaps that CVI was not able to address. Now, when the UNDP was leading the process to develop IVI, they decided to host it in Asia Pacific, because that's where a lot of the EPI fallback was located. That's where there was EPI failure uptakes, and there was still a lot of death from infectious diseases. So they decided to host it in Asia, and there was a competition between five countries. I think there was China, South Korea, Philippines, Thailand, Hong Kong. And South Korea ended up winning out. They had the most persuasive package to offer. And they offered to build a massive headquarters facility, including laboratories, on the campus of Seoul National University.
Korea, South Korea is a beautiful country. And they are a little bit advanced in biotech research. I mean, the last time I was in South Korea was 2017-18. Mm-hmm. In these years, and we visited Samsung, and I learned there that Samsung is investing a lot in biotech research. Can you highlight a little bit the life science biotech industry in South Korea from your from the IVI perspective?
Sure. So from the IVI perspective, in the lifetime of IVI, we've seen a significant growth in Korea's biotech sector, partially assisted by IVI. If we look back to the year, I want to say 2006, there was a SARS outbreak, and maybe it was 2013. My apologies if I'm getting the dates wrong. And there was a SARS outbreak, and Korea needed some flu vaccines. And they had an agreement with the manufacturers in the United States to purchase and supply those vaccines. But amidst the outbreak, the U.S. government intervened and said, well, actually, we have the first rights on those vaccines. And since there's a global health emergency, we will be taking those vaccines and not letting them go to Korea. So Korea was left in the lurch and was shocked by that development and decided that they need to make significant investments in their biotech industry to ensure that Korea had a stronger vaccine manufacturing and R&D capacity, so that they would no longer be reliant on vaccines of critical national health security. And so through a number of investments, both in basic R&D, but also in manufacturing, a number of Korean biotechs have been able to grow up and emerge. Samsung has its life sciences. SK also has a life science department, which we work with closely. I think sort of a flagship for IVI's partnership has been EU Biologics. EU Biologics was a very small biotech firm, had never made a vaccine. But we were able to take the oral cholera vaccine that we had developed and reformulated and transfer it to EU Biologics. And EU Biologics was able to step up, get that vaccine licensured and licensed and WHO pre-qualified, and is now one of the main significant global suppliers of oral cholera vaccine. Now what we see in Korea, and it's a continuing initiative, is Korea is now an example for other countries to follow of how investments across the spectrum and basic research, translation research, clinical trial capacity, manufacturing capacity, end up producing a network and an environment for vaccine manufacturing and supply.
I couldn't agree more. I think the pandemic was the best proof what's possible in the industry when everybody's working together. I was pretty much impressed by the achievement. I never thought it's possible to develop a new vaccine basically from scratch in 1 year and distribute it to the people. I always thought that manufacturing is a huge bottleneck, but if everything is working together, it works fine. Let's have a look at the life cycle of a vaccine and how IVI can help. My background is business, and I was involved in vaccine development, as I mentioned before, a couple of years ago. It's almost 10 years ago now. And from my perspective, it's always pretty simple what I have to do. So as a business expert, I have to look at the pharma industry, see what needs they define. Pharma companies usually are listed, are public companies listed on a stock market. So they have to take commercial rules very seriously. Otherwise, they simply would cease to exist. And this means they need a business model, a revenue model. They need enough cases in the world. They need someone to pay. And they need to make a profit. Otherwise, they would not fulfill their mission. And for me as a business expert in clinical development, preclinical development, it's pretty simple. When I see enough cases, when I see the potential for payers on the market, we can come to the conclusion we have a business case. It makes sense to invest some capital. I can approach investors. Investors put money in, and later off, we license the vaccine to the pharma companies. You mentioned before, and I saw this very often, that unfortunately, when no payers exist, so when nobody wants to cover the cost of the vaccine when it's distributed to the patients or to the people at the end of the day, then we don't have a business case. Otherwise, also when there are not sufficient cases, then we don't have a business case. But the need still exists. Now I learned from you that IVI, as far as I understood your explanation, is set up to fix that problem. So to pick up challenges that the pharma industry would turn down. And let's walk through the value chain. I think let's start with basic research. Let's explore a little bit what IVI, how IVI can help basic researchers. Let's look at preclinical development, tech transfer, clinical development, then bringing the thing to the market, the vaccine. And at the end of the day, also, let's have a look at the government level and see what IVI is doing there. Let's start with the basic researcher. So what if a basic researcher comes to me and they say, yes, nice idea, but I don't think that there is a market because nobody pays for it and there are no patients. What's IVI's role in that part of the value chain?
Okay, so I'm going to actually go one step behind you and start with evidence. And this is a basis on IVI's history. So IVI's first major global program was something called DOMI, which is the Diseases of the Most Impoverished Initiative. And this was made possible by funding from the Gates Foundation. And what DOMI did is it did a comprehensive disease burden study, a massive surveillance epidemiological operation across Asia and parts of Africa to determine what the true burden of these neglected diseases were. We conducted surveillance primarily for cholera, typhoid, and HIV, meningitis, rotavirus, and Shigella, to figure out what the true burdens of these diseases were. And in each case, it could be slightly different. In the cases of cholera and typhoid, we know, for example, that it can be seasonal, that it can pop up during rainy periods and flooding periods in certain countries. But that also that some countries don't like to report on their burden of cholera and typhoid because it's bad for investments. And a lot of officials believe that if they can just advance their WASH infrastructure, that cholera and typhoid will magically go away. So what we found is in many countries, cholera and typhoid were vastly unreported. And there was an endemic problem that was being ignored, that was costing lives and holding back the economy. So what we do first and foremost, and what we're still doing today, is disease surveillance in the fields. And the final products of those epidemiological projects are, one, disease burden data and evidence. Mm. And that's how you start to identify the need for a vaccine. You see that X amount of people are infected or suffering or dying from these diseases. And then you look at the economic burden. We also conduct the economic studies. We see, you know, what's the cost of illness for this disease? What's the DALI? You know, what are the, we take surveys. We see what are people's perceptions of these diseases and on a potential desire for a vaccine. And with that evidence, we're able to design and develop what are called vaccine investment cases, investment strategies. We share those with Gavi, as well as with decision makers in country, to show, look, you have this disease, you have this problem. And if you invest in vaccine uptake or vaccine R&D in some cases, then we can begin a virtuous upcycle in addressing this problem. So getting into basic research. So we start with an understanding of basic.
Can we stay a little bit on your level before we go into the basic research?
Sure.
So you pay for the studies and you do the studies basically to find out what is the real disease burden, what is the real economic burden of a disease, how many people are affected, and whether it makes sense to do something against it or not. Did I understand it right?
Yeah. So that brings up the funding question. An important part to realize is that IVI is primarily funded through philanthropy and governments and grants. Yeah. 90% of our funding typically comes from project grants, which we have to compete for on the open grant market, which we're pretty good at doing. We have a pretty good reputation at securing grants, but not always, as well as funding that we get from some of our member states. Mm. What's great when we do get core funding from our member states is that funds an independent research projects. So we can take, for example, core funding from member states and invest it directly in an epidemiology program or in basic research. Mm. We don't always have access to that funding, but when we do, we try to use it to target those exact diseases that have no market incentive.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there is no business case for these studies except getting grants on that. When it comes to forming public opinion, I think as long as the burden is not felt, there is no willingness to pay. And without your studies, the willingness to pay is not there. So basically, it's quite impressive what you do. I think in times of the internet, when I Google something, it always feels like the data is always there, but somebody has to produce the data before Google can recognize it. And your entity is doing that in the vaccine development. I didn't know that.
We've produced quite a few of the peer reviewed journal articles out there establishing the burden for a wide variety of diseases, and we're currently improving that on typhoid as well, which we can get into in a little while. So once we know a basic need, we can look at basic research on vaccine development. Now there's a couple ways we can approach that. First of all, IVI has its own laboratories going up to BSL-3. And we are able to initiate basic research in our own laboratories. We've done that right now with an invasive non-typhoidal salmonella vaccine candidate, as well as a Shigella vaccine candidate. and a number of smaller grants that we've been working on some hemorrhagic fever vaccines and some other vaccine initiatives to improve pre-existing vaccines. Alternatively, what we can do is we can partner up with private biotechs, academia, research institutes that have developed those basic vaccine candidates, and we can test them. We can run them through animal models. We have an animal facility for testing. We can develop adjuvants and assays for those vaccines and demonstrate the effectiveness. And again, it's about that cycle. So if we can demonstrate that we have a basic vaccine candidate, we can go to philanthropy, we can go to governments, and we can say, here's a promising candidate. If you provide us funding, we can carry it to the next stage.
So in the first step, you identified the need. In the second step, you also help with your own laboratories to develop vaccine candidates. So any entity, any company, any basic research institution, any university who believes they have something that helps ease the burden can approach you, and you evaluate then the project and work together with this entity. My question is coming from the business side again. Which model do you run? Is it a co-development model? Is it a is it a CRO model that basically you say, okay, give us your vaccine, we test it out, and you pay for it? What? How is that set up between the entities?
All of the above. We've taken all of those approaches in terms of developing vaccines. You know, we're a bit of a unique organism as an organization. Legally, we're an international organization. We function as a research institute, and we develop products or a product development partner. So yeah, all of those cases apply. They're all valid, and they all work in terms of putting out a vaccine. I can tell you in the case of our non-typhoidal salmonella vaccine, we developed it with our own money, and then we presented it to the Wellcome Trust. They saw the value in the vaccine and are now funding additional stages going into phase one clinical trials eventually. In other cases, I can think of there's the vaccine at Harvard working on tuberculosis. And so we're helping them with the early preclinical stages of developing that.
Do I understand it right that when you sign agreements, it's non-for-profit, basically, your work. So you cover your expenses and you're not planning for being profitable.
That's right. So IVI is a nonprofit organization. And when it comes to IP, we don't maintain the IP on these vaccines. We freely tech transfer these vaccines to manufacturers who are ready and willing and able to manufacture them. And when we do co-develop a vaccine with a partner, we require what's called a global access agreement, the standard model that also the Gates Foundation uses, that promises that if a vaccine is successfully developed, that the manufacturer or the IP holder will make a certain amount of doses available each year for use in global public health.
That's cool.
And that's the model that we've been able to sustain with Ubiologics, which has successfully filled that WHO vaccine stockpile for cholera.
So you're basically a facilitator and enabler in the industry that you pick up cases and help moving them forward very proactively and actively. Mm-hmm. And it's not just politics that you do. Mm-hmm. You also get your hands dirty in vaccine development and do the hard work in the laboratory.
Yeah, that a big difference between IVI and a lot of the other global players, our partners and friends, and organizations like Gavi and CEPI and the Global Fund, is that we're executors. We do the actual work. I think the governments and international development agencies, they like organizations like Gavi and CEPI, Global Fund, because they're downstream. They can donate lots of money to Gavi, CEPI, Global Fund, and then those organizations handle the money to fund basic research or to fund uptake, whereas we're actually in the nitty-gritty doing the work.
Yeah, I think this is also the huge problem that I see in any, not only in vaccines, but also in other areas. There's a lot of funding, especially in Europe, there's a lot of funding in basic research. Once a product has proven that it works, there's also enough partners to distribute it to the patients or people in terms of vaccines. They are not patients yet, mostly. And but in between, especially in Europe, there's a huge funding gap. So I think right. a little bit more funding and helping hands mm-hmm. in that area would be great. What is your role yeah. in clinical development and preclinical development?
So yeah, as you were just alluding to, so there's the great problem of the translational graveyard. We have lots of wonderful vaccine candidates sitting on shelves around the world collecting dust instead of saving lives. And that's because they lack the funding to push those vaccines through translational development, to turn them from prototypes into viable products, and then to find manufacturers who are willing to do that. So we facilitate that process. We're able to do that in-house. We have the vaccine process development in-house that we can do for other product, other partner vaccines, external vaccines. And then we also have a strong network of CMOs around the world and clinical trial sites. So one of the nice things about our epidemiology network that we have is it also doubles into a clinical trial network around the world in 40 different countries, that once we have a vaccine scaled up to manufacturing, actually, you know, what we do a lot is as part of the tech transfers, we work with developing country vaccine manufacturers. We can move a vaccine candidates to India or Vietnam or Indonesia, even Bangladesh now, South Africa as well, where they have a better economies of scale and a lower production costs. And that's where we can get the first trial batches manufactured for clinical trials. And if we demonstrate effectiveness through clinical trials, then of course, continue manufacturing there. I think in the case of Europe, that's something that European biotechs can start looking into is as vaccine manufacturing capacity grows around the world, European developers should realize that they could manufacture their vaccines in Africa, Latin America, or Asia, and maintain profitability in doing so.
Yeah, the world is a bit different in 2023 than it was in the mm-hmm. 90s. So I think also mm-hmm. the regions that you described evolved. Mm-hmm. But we spared one part, and I want to pick on that. I mean, CMOs, CROs, they're all great. They're all doing a great work, but mm-hmm. at least the ones that I know don't work for mm-hmm. free for me. So they always want to be paid. I think it's mm-hmm. also in your case that they don't cover their mm-hmm. expenses themselves and are suddenly become a philanthropic entity. They also need money. The big question that I have and mm-hmm. the big bottleneck I always see in Europe is mm-hmm. funding. How do you get the funding? How do you mobilize capital mm-hmm. for these areas?
Mm-hmm. So again, there's multiple areas. So first, IVI doesn't manufacture vaccines. Mm-hmm. We go up to process development before we transfer. And part one possible solution again is the global access agreement, where the manufacturer will be able to manufacture X amount of doses for sale in the private sector and another amount of doses for use in public health. But then also from our grant applications, some of the grants that we apply for will include funding for transfer to CDOs or CDMOs. Mm-hmm.
So basically it's grants. And how can we motivate private investors to put money in? Do you have anything on the mm-hmm. agenda?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
Yeah, so I mean, that's an interesting question of, you know, venture capital in investing in vaccine development, vaccine manufacturing. I think there is a space. We're working with a vaccine developer in the U.S. and Texas on a COVID-19 vaccine variants, and they have venture capital funding. And I think what you have to do from a finance perspective is what's your ROI? What's your profit margin looking at? Are you willing to take a little bit of a cut to see this candidate get through the process? If you can accept the global access agreements, which might cut off 1 or 2% of your margin, is that acceptable or not? It could be, because once that vaccine is out there, it might be the only vaccine available on the market, and you'll have exclusive access on the market.
Yeah, I think when I look at the outlier years, 2020 to 2023, I think I was really impressed how quick the industry moves. But when I look before 2020, I think the investing market was pretty dried up for vaccines. There was not much going, at least I was not aware of that there was much going on. And the fear that after 2022, we go back to normal. What trends do you see in financing for vaccines? Is there still this spirit of let's solve the biggest problems and put money in, or are we coming back to pre-pandemic levels with funding?
So far, so good. From what I can, from my perspective, things are sustained at the current level. One organization that we're working with in the US is Open Philanthropy, and they're gradually expanding their funding for some of our vaccine development programs, which is a promising sign. And Open Philanthropy is a very interesting model where venture capital investors will all pool their funding together and then in a very dynamic level, pick promising projects like IVI vaccine development projects to advance. So I think the question that I have to deal with from a government relations perspective is attention and interest from policymakers and governments. They realize that vaccines and global health and infectious diseases are a problem, but they're very quickly overtaken by other events.
I should just chat. Is this entity Open Philanthropy?
Yes, that's correct. That's Open Philanthropy.
So they're also doing grants for vaccine researchers. So if somebody who listens to our episodes doesn't know that, it's also something where you can apply for grants for vaccine development.
It's also important to highlight the role of CEPI, the Coalition of Epidemic Preparedness Initiatives. CEPI was established prior to the COVID-19 outbreak, actually just, I think, 2 years before it happened. And they're a funding mechanism where they bring in funding from governments and industry and philanthropy to advance clinical trial development of vaccines up to stage two in most cases. Sometimes up to stage three, for diseases that have an emerging pandemic potential. COVID-19 is a big one. Another one they're looking at, chikungunya or Nipah. CEPI has made a significant contribution towards addressing that funding gap. And, I think there is sustained support from governments and private sector of supporting CEPI. And CEPI is an answer for a lot of these diseases, but CEPI isn't the answer for all vaccines, because, again, their specific focus is on vaccines with the pandemic potential. But there are plenty of diseases out there that have a sustained endemic burden long-term in low- and middle-income countries. That have no threat of spreading towards the West, which still need to be funded.
Let's stay a little bit with the regions that you mentioned, Asia, Africa, and Latin America. I mean, as I said, there must always be a challenge that there is an opportunity to develop a vaccine. Can we explore a bit the situation and unique challenges and opportunities in each region? Let's start I know it's a big region and it's unfair to call it that. Asia, I think this is 2/3 of the global population, am I right? One half of the global population. Which unique challenges do you see in Asia for vaccine development?
One that's come up, especially in COVID-19, is regulatory approval. So we work with ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, which is an international organization or community similar to the EU, which incorporates a number of the countries in Southeast Asia. And we've been working with the National Vaccine Institute in Thailand and other partners within ASEAN to explore how we can improve vaccine uptake and access within ASEAN. If you look in ASEAN, you have a wide variety of development levels. You have high-income countries like Singapore, you have low-income countries like Laos or Cambodia, and you have middle-income countries like Vietnam and Indonesia. And all of them have varying capacity for basic research, for vaccine R&D, for clinical trials management and manufacturing. And so the question is, can we build a system within ASEAN that will coordinate comprehensive vaccine development between those partners, as well as a pan-regulatory authority within ASEAN? So that's an interesting way of look at. You know, we work with Indonesia, for example, their manufacturer Biopharma on developing and manufacturing a new typhoid conjugate vaccine. And we've also worked historically with Vietnam on cholera vaccine. So there's a lot of potential there to develop vaccines. And to be frank, in the last 25 years, Asia has done a miraculous job of addressing childhood illnesses from infectious disease and improving the epi levels. What you run into with a lot of these middle-income countries, though, be it Indonesia or Malaysia or Vietnam, is the middle-income gap, or what's sometimes called the Gavi gap, where low-income countries have access to Gavi subsidization for vaccine uptake. But as their economy grows and they transition out, they gradually lose access to those low cost price agreements for vaccines. And they gradually are put in a position where they have to buy vaccines at the going market rate, which then makes those vaccines unavailable for their populations.
Is this such a huge turning point that when countries become, let's put it bluntly, richer, they fall out of this agreement where they get access, cheap access to vaccines, and then they have to pay? Mm-hmm. Is it such a huge turning point that the countries then can't afford it?
Luckily, it's not a huge on-off switch. Gavi works very closely with those countries on a transition process, where it's in many cases delayed or drawn out so that it doesn't have a blunt impact. And you can look at the nationwide statistics and things look okay, but then you have on the individual level need for vaccines like pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, which are very expensive and become even more expensive when you have to buy them on the private market. There's some interesting things we're working on in case of human papillomavirus, HPV. So there are vaccines available on the market. And what we've done in Thailand is conducted a study to prove that a single dose of vaccine is similarly effective to three doses of vaccine. Okay. And that evidence has led to approval for use of one dose of vaccine. And that will significantly reduce costs for countries in providing those vaccines to their population.
This is a great success. Congratulations. Yes. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. So Asia is a success story. And of course, you have to look, if you really want to talk about Asia, you have to look at the powerhouse of India as a vaccine manufacturer and developer. I think it's something like India supplies something like 70% of the world's vaccines in terms of consumption.
70%.
I might be wrong on that number, but it's really, really high. A significant amount of the world's vaccines are manufactured in India and consumed in India. So you're looking at the populations in Asia and in Africa using Indian vaccines from manufacturers like Serum Institute.
I'm just curious. Sorry to interrupt you. My apologies for interrupting. India is manufacturing basically for the pharma industry globally. Do you also know for Europe? Do we get most of our vaccination from India already?
I think there are some vaccines in Europe that are manufactured in India, but I don't have the full scope off the top of my head. Yeah,
I was hoping you can close my knowledge gaps here very quickly.
But I know some Indian vaccines have received licensure EMA approval.
Super. Now, India has evolved tremendously in the last 20 years. I had, I think 2 years ago, I had a colleague who started a company in India already in the 90s. And it's impressive what he said, how the entire ecosystem evolved during the last two or three decades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Asia has also been the centerpiece for IVI's vaccine technology transfers, which we've done considerable work on. The oral cholera vaccine that we developed originally came from Jan Holgrim at University of Gothenburg in Sweden. And then it was manufactured in Vietnam by VA Biotech under the name Morkvac. And we were able to take that vaccine and reformulate it into a more effective, low-cost version and transfer that from Vietnam to India, to Shantha Biotechnics. And later we were able to transfer that vaccine to a Bangladeshi company, Encepta. And
my apologies for interrupting again, but I think I have to put your organization into a different bucket. It sounds to me, when you say we got a hold on the vaccine and we developed it and transferred it, it sounds more to me like you're acting like a pharmaceutical company. That you, how do you do it commercially? Do you license the vaccine to get the licensing rights, then hire a CMO or CDMO to produce the vaccine? Is it how can you imagine that? How do you do that?
So we do it again through agreements with the IP holders, the license holders. Again, we don't take the license, we don't hold the IP. It's on a voluntary basis with the owners of that IP, whether they want to work on it or not on that project.
But you are really more hands-on than any other organization on this is similar to yours.
That's right. That's right. Lots of organizations might fund such activities, but we actually get them done. Yeah. And there's been a number of other vaccine transfers of interest. You know, we transferred an early typhoid vaccine, a polysaccharide vaccine from China to India, and later India transferred it to Pakistan with our help. We can get into vaccine diplomacy later, but it's interesting to see that countries that are often in tension with each other are able to cooperate on vaccine development.
It's good to know.
Yeah.
How is the situation in Africa?
So Africa provides a different challenge. We're just starting now in the conversation on vaccine manufacturing in Africa. But what we're doing in Africa is building capacity across a wide variety of countries, both in epidemiology and clinical trial capacity. So in Africa, we have high burdens for diseases like cholera, typhoid, non-typhoidal salmonella, schistosomiasis. And what we do in Africa is different from the traditional development agency model. A traditional development agency will fly into Africa with its team and its equipment, its supplies, do the work and fly out. And that's not sustainable. I don't think that's how we want to do things in the contemporary future. What we do instead is we lead from behind. We go into places in Africa. We provide training, capacity building. We provide equipment for local hospitals to build their capacity in epidemiology and in clinical trial research. And through sustained development, through practice, through training, these local hospitals and research institutes and clinics become viable vaccine development partners, at least for the portion of collecting evidence, generating evidence, and conducting the clinical trials.
Can we hold a little bit at this point, our capacity building? Let's dive a little bit deeper into that. What is capacity building?
Sure. So simply put, capacity building means, and it's often a meaningless term in some cases of you know, popular speak, but what it basically means is it's training and empowerment. It's giving people the tools and abilities they need to do the work. And we can do that through training in our vaccinology course. It can mean providing equipment like freezers, microscopes, office space, constructing buildings to do the work in, providing computer systems, software systems for data management. The fact is there's plenty of within Africa, there's educated population who are eager to work on this. They have the nascent capacity. They have the basic understanding and ability to do the work. They just need a step up to be able to reach their full potential.
And do you see a difference to other initiatives that basically you said they fly into the job and fly out? Have you done any measurements in the last 1 or 2 decades that show that capacity building is more effective on the long run than other approaches?
Yeah, I think in Africa, one little statistic we'd like to cite is that through our developments, we've created, I think, 1,000 jobs in Africa through our capacity building programs. And that's 1,000 people working in their healthcare sector and contributing value, not just domestically, but also internationally. And epidemiology and clinical trials. I'll also add one additional thing is that if you look at the career paths of the people that we train and we assist, is they go on to advance through the healthcare system. They end up going into regulatory positions, which then mm-hmm. strengthen the government's ability to respond to diseases and outbreaks, as well as to license treatments. So it's once we plant the seed of this training and work, the people that we work with then grow into the sector and make a larger impact across time.
That's great to hear. Capacity building, is it something that you do occasionally as IVI, or is it part of your strategy that you say, okay, it's mm-hmm. very important, so we put it on our strategic portfolio list and mm-hmm. moved it forward on a larger scale?
Yeah, it's an integral part of our strategy, providing training. One example we like to cite, or one model we like to cite, is South-South triangular cooperation. Another buzzword, but it actually does have significant meaning in our work. We look across the spectrum at low and middle income countries, and we see individuals and institutes and countries that have a piece of the puzzle. They have something to contribute, something that they're excelling at, and we can bring them together to build each other's capacity. So, for example, we could take clinical researchers from Nepal, for example, take them to India, and use our partners in India will train them in more advanced clinical procedures. And then they'll go off and do the work themselves. We actually did that with North Korean epidemiologists in the early 2000s. We took them from North Korea and brought them to China and Vietnam for more advanced training and capacity building and vaccine delivery. And so as a result, instead of this top-down model where, different countries, low and middle-income countries, are continually dependent on high-income countries for training, capacity building, by linking them together, they can train each other and build upon each other's abilities.
I mean, it's same thing since you mentioned North Korea. So there is collaboration also with North Korea.
There was in the past. Currently, there is none because of the sanctions. We would work in North Korea if we could. I think we have a plan sitting on a shelf somewhere of projects that we could work on. Mm-hmm. In the past, we were able to conduct epidemiology programs, capacity building, and some vaccination campaigns against Japanese encephalitis and HIV meningitis.
I'm a European. I believe in peaceful collaboration. So I think this is it's good with countries or people from different countries work together. It helps to create more understanding for similarities also for differences.
We're willing to work with anyone to save lives in any country.
That's a great attitude. When we look at Africa, it's mostly capacity building. We discussed a little bit about Asia. I mean, I would really love to dive very deep into each topic, but also don't want to use too much of your time. It's really fun talking to you, and we are already at 1 hour. That's why I suggest let's move on to Latin America. How is the situation that we highlight a little bit Latin America?
Sure. So in Latin America, historically, IVI's presence in Latin America focused on mosquito-borne diseases. And so throughout the 2000s and 2010s, we worked very closely with partners in Latin America, across Central America and South America, on disease surveillance and regulatory research on dengue and Zika. Once the Zika outbreak took place from Brazil. And recently, we've been working on chikungunya. So for those who aren't aware of what chikungunya is, It is a debilitating infectious disease, a virus spread by mosquitoes. And while it's not often lethal, chikungunya causes something similar to arthritis, where it causes joint inflammation and pain, which prevents people from being able to move, from preventing people to work. So it has an enormous impact on dalis and on economic developments in these countries. So currently we're conducting a clinical trial in Costa Rica, Panama, and Colombia on a chikungunya vaccine developed by Bharat Biotech in India. And so we're conducting phase two clinical trials now on that vaccine. And in Latin America, a lot of the partners there already have good capacity, good regulatory capacity, good clinical trial capacity. So there's not so much training going on there, so much as it is cooperation. However, Panama recently ratified the IVI establishment agreement. And we're in early talks of perhaps hosting some training there where we can bring in researchers from across Latin and South America, and bring them into Panama City and provide a vaccinology course to local researchers.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Coaching Conversation 2024. This podcast is 100% dedicated to leadership and leadership within the workplace coaching area. We work with companies throughout the world teaching leaders how to coach their employees. This podcast is dedicated to teaching specific strategies, frameworks, coaching models, and now artificial intelligence strategies to help leaders drive greater teamwork, collaboration, cooperation, greater attitudes, better motivation, coaching career development, just to name a few. I hope you'll check out our podcast.
You mentioned two diseases, dengue and chikungunya. Why is it so challenging to develop a vaccine for that? I mean, I remember it was already a problem 10 years ago, and 10 years ago it was, I think, already a long-lasting problem from a few decades before. Why is it so challenging to bring something effective to the market?
Mm-hmm. I think the problem, I mean, every vaccine provides its own unique problems. You're probably aware of the fact that 90% of all vaccines fail at some point in their development. So the ability to get a functional vaccine all the way through preclinical and clinical trials is incredibly difficult and challenging. You know, Sanofi experienced that with their dengue vaccine, where they found that the vaccine could cause some adverse effects in people who have already been infected with dengue prior to vaccination. So the dengue, we actually helped with the dengue vaccine candidate, which is now I think in final steps with Butantan in Brazil. So the US NIH, the National Institutes of Health, developed a vaccine candidate for dengue, and we helped conduct the technology transfer of that to Brazil and helped assist some of the early clinical trial stages of that. And I think they're approaching licensure now of that vaccine. Sure. So I think it's just, again, it's a matter of developing that virtuous cycle of policymakers and investors realizing that there is a need for the vaccine, that there's a demand for the vaccine, and the value that that vaccine will deliver to the population, not only in terms of health, but economics as well.
I mean, it's 10 years ago that I have read studies on chikungunya and dengue, but the assumption was with climate change and increasing global warming, more people will be affected in future from this virus. So it will go more northwards. Yes. And I think I also saw parts of Europe being, is it still the same assumption that with climate change, we will see more cases also in the Northern Hemisphere?
Yeah, I think it's highly likely that we will see climate change make an impact on the spreads of these diseases. We're seeing that with chikungunya, where previously in Latin America it was isolated in certain areas, but it wasn't in the colder highlands. But now that those highlands are warming up, you're seeing more chikungunya cases. I think I've even heard that it's been found in Texas already.
Oh, really?
So again, CEPI is funding our vaccine clinical trial because CEPI is aware that this vaccine has a potential to spread on a high level into the Northern Hemisphere and affect large populations.
Let's step a little bit into science fiction. I mean, when I started in vaccine development, I was hoping to learn that we have the potential to find a vaccine that basically wipes out the virus and you vaccinate the population one time and everything is done. Do you see something coming like that, that we can find a technology that makes vaccines so effective that we can basically eradicate certain viruses? Or is it something too far in the future?
Well, you know, I'm more of a diplomat, so I'm not a vaccine scientist, so I can't comment too much on it. Yeah. That being said, the technological innovations that have popped up recently with mRNA, for example, and DNA as well, are showing some promise and effectiveness. But whether or not you can eliminate disease entirely is another question. I mean, we know from economic and infrastructure development in the West that we were able to eliminate cholera and typhoid. You know, if I go and read the newspapers from my hometown from the 1880s, there were regular cholera outbreaks in downtown Cincinnati. That doesn't happen anymore because we closed down the stagnant swamps that were running through the city. So we know that it can disappear from certain locations, but again, there's always the potential for an environmental reservoir. One interesting study we're doing now, so IVI developed a new typhoid vaccine, and in order to generate evidence on its effectiveness and use, we're currently conducting a vaccination campaign in Fiji, in the northern island of Fiji, to see if we can eliminate typhoid entirely from the island. The hypothesis is that if we vaccinate enough people and establish herd immunity, that we could make typhoid disappear from a contained population. However, there's also the possibility that there is an environmental reservoir of typhoid in the water sources there. So once we conduct the vaccination campaign, if we see typhoid persisting, we'll be able to have evidence that vaccination alongside, you know, environmental management is going to be a key to eliminating a disease from the environment.
So I think what I got from what you said is that many diseases are complex problems that cannot be tied down to a single shot solution. So it includes more parts of the ecosystem to work together.
Yeah, and we also have to remember that so many of the most threatening diseases these days are zoonotic infectious diseases, diseases that transfer from animals to humans. If that disease is spreading vector through different animals, coronaviruses, for example, are a classic case of that. You know, MERS coming from camels. So what we need to establish is preventative vaccines and animal control and animal epidemiology to track the spreads of these. Other infectious diseases that we see prop up, hemorrhagic fevers. So right now there's a Marburg fever outbreak in Africa. I believe it was in Gambia or the Guinea-Bissau, where there's currently a spread of Marburg, and that can have an animal vector. We're looking at a tick-borne hemorrhagic fever called severe fever with thrombocytopenia. And that's currently spread by a tick, which, of course, Austria is famous for its ticks. And that tick is currently isolated in China and Japan and Korea. But there's a threat that tick will spread through trade and through climate change, and that SFTS will travel with it. And this hemorrhagic fever has a 25% mortality rate. We're looking at hantavirus as well, which is spread by mice. So I think we have to take a comprehensive approach. We're looking at that now in AMR, a One Health approach, not just human health, but animal health. IVI doesn't work too much in animal health, but I think the global health community at large has to take a holistic approach to containing these diseases.
Mm-hmm. I mean, vaccines is one part of the equation to solve these problems. The other parts then is, I mean, protecting vulnerable populations and also promoting socioeconomic development. Is IVI solely focused on the vaccine development part, or do you also tap into the other parts? Do you look more at the evolvement of the disease and how you can stop the disease from spreading?
Mm-hmm. So IVI focuses on the vaccine and the vaccine development, but as part of our developing evidence and demonstrating a need, we conduct the economic studies and that demonstrate the economic value of these diseases. So again, that's showing the economic burden that these diseases cause and the economic value that would come from developing and implementing these vaccines.
But I think this, but I think also, I mean, when I look at the lower income countries, we also need a lot of development in the countries of the infrastructure. Who takes care of that? Is this on IVI's mission, or is this still an open question mark? You mentioned cholera before and typhoid, and said that in Cincinnati, I think it was Cincinnati, that basically the vaccines alone didn't solve the problem, but you also had to work on the infrastructure. Who is doing that on a global level?
So there are other partners who work on that. We do a little bit of work on that. We do a little bit of WASH training and exercises. When we do vaccination efficacy studies and campaigns, we'll frequently provide WASH training to the populations. We've also, in Madagascar not too long ago, we helped address the spread of schistosomiasis by improving access to clean water and toilets. So we built some toilets in Madagascar and built some wells within communities to protect them from exposure to schistosomiasis in the normal freshwater regions.
Is it sustainable? I mean, when you build them, how's the situation a few years later? Are they still there and working, or would it need some additional training? Capacity building is the term you used before.
Right. So, I mean, it's one thing to build something, but then people have to maintain it. So that's when we build these things, we work with the locals to make sure that they have the tools and the training and the resources necessary to not only build it themselves, but then maintain it once the work is done. So when IVI helped establish these facilities in Madagascar, it wasn't an IVI scientist doing the work. It was a Malagasy worker from his community doing the work.
Yeah, that's great. That's great to hear. I mean, this is also, I think, a problem of diplomacy then to bring globally the resources together. How important is diplomacy, in your opinion, to solve these problems?
So, you know, vaccine diplomacy, I think you can, there's two types of vaccine diplomacy, and you can summarize it in the old adage of, give someone a fish or teach them to fish. And it's the same with vaccine diplomacy. So the traditional model, the easy model, if you're a policymaker or a government official or diplomat, is to give the fish. So it's to contribute funding to an international organization so that they can buy products on the downstream side. And then just throw money at the problem and do a photo op and walk away happy. The harder part of teaching someone to fish, which you could characterize as vaccine science diplomacy, as you can already tell from IVI's work, it's a lot more arduous. It's a lot more dirty and hands-on, and it takes a lot more time. And with vaccine diplomacy, the outcomes are usually pretty quick, which is valuable for a politician. Who has to demonstrate, you know, value to his voters or to his boss, you know, he can, you know, donate money to Gavi or to global funds and then say, I did X amounts of this and it's done. But if it takes 10 years to develop a vaccine and that's, you know, two or three election cycles away and you've made no progress, that's a much harder sell to the public and to the ministries of finance.
But how can we solve this problem? I mean, to see it very often in Europe, this analogy that you brought up, it's either giving the fish, and I think it was the podcast with Jack Scannell who said, once you have identified the problem, throwing money at the problem is not always the right solution. And the harder part is teaching to fish. I mean, when you look at Europe, for example, I see this problem growing in the last two decades. So I think the public funding for basic research is getting bigger and bigger and bigger every year. But then comes the bottleneck of private funding, because public funding doesn't fund usually clinical trials. Public funding doesn't fund market access. Public funding usually, except the pandemic, doesn't fund also distribution of vaccines. The thing is that I see then a lot of solutions sitting on the shelf that you mentioned before, but not moving forward. What can we do to come from the give the fish attitude, or transition from the give the fish attitude more to, wouldn't it be better to set the right framework of regulations in place that help teaching people to fish?
Part of that falls on our shoulders of responsibility of showing that it can be done, showing that it's worked in the past, and that it's not impossible. It is easy to get into this system. There is a system in place, the IVI approach, for example, of developing a vaccine from evidence through licensure and delivery. It's there, it works. It's a proven model. And so the funders, they have to expand their horizons. They have to expand what's possible through their grant mechanisms to facilitate these problems, because what you've pointed out is absorption capacity. A good example of that is African vaccine manufacturing. So in the post-pandemic environment, we've had $5 billion donated to Africa for vaccine manufacturing, and another $10 billion promised for African vaccine manufacturing. That's $15 billion for African vaccine manufacturing, and there's only 10 manufacturers in all of Africa.
It's $1.5 billion each then.
Exactly. And then you also have the lack of the regulatory capacity, and then you have limited clinical trial capacity. You have very limited basic research capacity. So the problem is that a lot of policymakers get tunnel vision towards one easy solution. It's like, okay, I'm going to put funding in African vaccine manufacturing because that sounds good. Or I'm going to put all the funding into basic research because that looks good. But if you're not taking the holistic, comprehensive approach to the industry and to the life cycle of a vaccine as a product, then again, you're not gonna have success. You're gonna have limited outcomes, as you mentioned.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I understand the problem that you point out, that a politician, basically a policymaker, has a 4-year or 5-year cycle, so he or she has to produce results. Putting on the holistic glasses means deciding on solutions that show first effects probably in 10 or 15 years and not in 4 or 5 years, when now the, let's call it, competition from another party focuses more on short-term solutions, which are, for example, building a plant. I mean, you see the plant, it's there, it can be built in 4 years, and it's something tangible. So in the eye of the voter, probably the party with the short-term solution, which doesn't have a long-term effect, on a holistic effect, looks better than the person who thinks holistically and puts the long-term solution in place. Do you have an easy solution to fix that problem?
Not yet. You know, it's the million-dollar question. It's a work in progress, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's up to us. That's something that we have to do to demonstrate that value. There are certain countries, there are certain partners and organizations in the world that see that value and have funded towards it thus far. We can bring up the Gates Foundation or the Wellcome Trust, for example, or countries like historic funders of IVI, like Sweden and Korea, which see the value in these long-term cycles. I would ask you the same question. You know, what do you think? How do we improve the sales pitch towards the governments and the policymakers?
It's a good question. I was hoping that you have the answer. I mean, when I look at the problem, I think it's a problem of democracies, basically. So this short term support. When I think about other political systems, I mean, you don't have to talk about it if you don't want to, just say, and we switch to another question. I was just thinking, I mean, China has a different system. Saudi Arabia has a different system in place. Also some African countries. Do you see, or also North Korea mentioned before, do you see in such countries for some decisions like long-term effects in vaccine development, for example, do you see a possibility that they are more likely to put on the holistic long-term glasses when they make decisions than democracies? I think in democracies it's really difficult.
You raise a very interesting question, and it's one that I think a lot of funding recipients are reluctant to address for fear of hurting anybody's feelings or harming relations. when we look at our partners, we don't consider so much, you know, a form of government just as much as a commitment to global health and domestic health and protecting populations. That's the key thing. Because when you look at countries that have different forms of governments, they still have the same priority of helping their people, protecting their people, growing their economies. So it's feasible to develop a value proposition and to show the efficacy of in making these long-term investments. But in those communities, you also need an access to information to clarify what the challenges are, what the risks are, and what the potential solutions to those are. You know, if you're in a government that's always on the positive side of things, always highlighting the positive things, it's hard to do the SWOT analysis and to say, well, maybe you should do this and this rather than just the one thing. So I think it's going to be a challenge across any kind of governments.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, in my uneducated point of view, when I look at the last three decades, so I graduated in the 90s, mm-hmm. and I think when I look at the decline of poverty, for example, and also the technological advancement globally, I believe mm-hmm. One part of this advancement was global collaboration. So as you mentioned, that countries mm-hmm. work together on solving problems, that companies mm-hmm. work together with governments on solving problems mm-hmm. and do that on a global basis. I think the mm-hmm. worst thing that can happen to our society or the human population on this planet is that we fall back basically in a thinking like it was in 1800, that everybody starts seeing just their own country and mm-hmm. stop global collaboration. I think the solution is always bring people, bring the experts together globally. Mm-hmm. How do you see that when it comes to global collaboration?
On that, I think we've had quite a bit of success. I think IVI has staff from 23, 24 different nationalities, and each of them provides their own network of contacts across a number of different countries. And we have programs in a wide variety of mm-hmm. countries across the world. And there is an interest in bridging that gap. You know, we were talking about vaccine science diplomacy. A great example we can bring up is Albert Sabin and Mikhail Chernikov, the Soviet scientist and they were behind the global effort for oral polio vaccine. So they worked on that project at my alma mater, University of Cincinnati. That's where they started it. And while the governments of the US and Soviet Union later promoted and celebrated the work of those scientists, while they were in the early stages of the process, both the KGB and the FBI were actively trying to prevent it. So we have this challenge of scientists across borders and countries want to work together and see the value of working together. In some circumstances, we can do it with the governments. In circumstances, we have to do it without them. And then we have to find the funding resources elsewhere, private sector, philanthropy, and build our own path. And if we can do that, we can demonstrate value, which governments will then later invest in after the fact.
I mean, I'm coming from the business side. I think finding mm-hmm. the funding might be difficult without governments, but it's mm-hmm. possible. I think what's impossible without governments is having laws in place that allow people to work together instead of laws that prohibit global collaboration. And mm-hmm. For example, when I run a company and I see an expert sitting in the United States and the other expert in India and the next experts in China, and mm-hmm. potentially you mentioned North Korea from the business perspective, I would say, okay, mm-hmm. I need to pull these experts together to solve the problem mm-hmm. so that we can move forward. Mm-hmm. But sometimes regulations work in a different direction. How can IVI help to mm-hmm. keep this mm-hmm. global collaboration in the minds of politicians globally, mm-hmm. governments globally? What's mm-hmm. your role in that?
I think the example that was demonstrated by Sabin and Chernikov on the oral polio vaccine is a really a key benchmark that we can follow. Luckily, the vaccine development programs that we've been able to complete with our partner countries through tech transfers and hosting clinical trials has demonstrated that it's possible to work across borders, to share technology, and it's not a zero-sum game. It's not a win-lose situation. It's a win-win situation. If we are able to develop the capacity for one country to manufacture vaccines and another to conduct basic research, another to do clinical trials, those three countries can work together to complete the development of vaccine. And it's been done. And we can do it again and again and again. And the end outcome, which of course you can measure through sustainable development goals, is a reduction in poverty among the population, which leads to economic growth, higher education attainment. There's a return on investment of vaccines. I think it's what $1 spent is like $16 returned. The evidence is there, and we can do it. But I think it's the timeline that we really run into that hurts the process. Hurts the sales pitch.
That's always the problem. Colin, it's great talking to you. I have two questions left. So one question is talking a little bit about your expansion to Austria. And the second question is about the future of IVI's mission and your role in the organization. Mm-hmm. Before I ask these two questions, did I miss anything in our recording? Is there something that you would like to address or a question you would like me to ask?
I think we've covered a lot of the material on what IVI is doing globally. And I hope I've been able to answer some questions about what IVI is and what our role are and what our role is and how we're different from other organizations in the field. I know we have a couple participants online. I'm fine to take questions, but I think so anyway. But at any rate, I'll be happy to talk about IVI's work in Europe and Austria these days.
Mm-hmm. Would be great.
Sure. So as part of IVI's new strategy, we realized that we had to get out of our comfort zone. For the last 20, 25 years, our headquarters has been in South Korea, which has had plenty of benefits and advantages, but the disadvantages are also worth noting. Most of our work these days takes place in Africa. So there is an 8-hour time zone difference between Korea and the time zones in Africa, which makes it very difficult to coordinate meetings. You lose time on getting agreements completed and data sharing and discussion. Also, a lot of the global health decision-making takes place in Europe. And Brussels and Geneva and to a degree in Vienna as well, London. So by putting an IVI office in Europe, a couple good things come out. First of all, our researchers are able to work more effectively with partners in Africa, as well as the Middle East, something we're looking at. And then we're also able to get a seat at the table. We're able to get into the World Health Assembly and work with philanthropic organizations who have small meetings on the sidelines across Europe. We're also able to get access to the EU Horizons and EDCDP funding to help expand our work. And there's a great network of European biotech. There's plenty of potential capacity available to work with. So a couple of years ago, IVI hosted a competition to host a call for proposal to host an office in Europe. And we received three finalists. There was Austria, Sweden, and France. And all the proposals were very generous. But because Sweden was one of the founding members of IVI, our board decided to put the office in Sweden. That being said, the offer that we received from Austria was incredibly generous and very interesting. And so we went back to Austria and said, what do you think about us establishing a smaller office to establish those same goals and objectives we previously discussed? Would Austria still be interested in hosting IVI? And the answer was resoundingly yes. And so last year, we quickly went through the process of setting up the plan to host this office here. And in terms of what we're doing here in Austria, so we just finished the seat agreement signed, so we're now fully established. The Austrian government is now exploring membership in IVI, potentially joining as a member state later this year. And now we're here to offer cooperation opportunities with Austrian research institutes and companies. We have the potential to advance the introduction of Austrian biotech and vaccine innovations into use for global public health. There's potential for us, IVI and Austrian partners to develop consortiums, centered on vaccine R&D, joint grant application, training and capacity building programs. there's a lot of potential in the country and region that we want to explore and work out what we can do together.
So basically, just a blunt example. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if there would be if there was a company developing a new formulation so that vaccines mm-hmm. become orally available that before mm-hmm. weren't orally available, could mm-hmm. they approach you asking you for joint research, for collaboration, for moving mm-hmm. Their research forward?
That's right. Yeah. So if there is in Austria or elsewhere, if there is a research institute or a biotech firm who thinks that they have a promising vaccine candidate or associated technology, we invite them to contact us and approach us, and we can see if there's potential to work together. Mm.
Then let's come to the final question, IVI's mm-hmm. future. Mm-hmm. How do you, as the global affairs manager at IVI, how do mm-hmm. you see the future of your institution in the last mm-hmm. 10, in the next 10, 20, 30 mm-hmm. years?
That's a good question. So my goal as global affairs manager is to manage our diplomatic relations with our member states. And so my commission, my objective is to get as many countries as possible to join IVI. And so my mission over the next 5-10 years, however long it be, is to demonstrate and communicate IVI's value to potential partner countries. The value that IVI presents, its unique role and capacity for developing vaccines, and to facilitate the growth and opportunities for local biotech companies, the ability to achieve progress in the sustainable development goals, and address infectious diseases that are an emerging problem with climate change, with AMR, that presents a heavy burden on the health of women and children and affect mortality rates. IVI is able to make a great impact, and through partnerships with IVI, countries can also make a great impact in global health. So in the next year, so this year, starting in October, IVI is establishing a global council. So IVI is evolving more towards its role as an international organization. So from October, I think 19, we'll be hosting our inaugural Global Council meeting, in which all of our member states will come together and begin advising IVI on its strategy and direction and how we can be of service to individual countries and global health as a whole.
That sounds good. The science fiction question I still have for the end. Yeah. Do you see the possibility to a one fixes all diseases vaccine? Basically, that mRNA. I was always hoping mm-hmm. that mRNA that it can be really used for covering a lot of topics with one vaccine. Mm-hmm. What do you see on the technology side for the future in your area? Yeah. But as a global affairs manager, mm-hmm. I know that you're more on the diplomatic side. But mm-hmm. what you see in your daily work, do you see any breakthrough technology in the pipeline where you can say, okay, I mean, might not fix all problems we have with viruses, mm-hmm. but there's potential that we can fix globally for the entire human race, the majority of problems.
That's the goal of IVI. And ultimately, the goal is to shut down IVI by eliminating all these infectious diseases, to close up the shop and move on to something else. I think we're a long way away from that. There are so many interesting technologies coming up. We have, of course, the mRNA technology. In terms of technology innovations that IVI focuses on, we're looking at things like encapsulation, mm-hmm. vaccines in pill form, which of course address issues with temperature control. Looking at vaccine patches, a patch that you stick on your arm to apply a vaccine, which also deals with delivery and temperature and cost issues. I'm a fan of sci-fi as well. And I wonder if we're going to see future developments in CRISPR or gene editing that will be able to confer natural levels of immunity. Will we be able to modify or edit the immune system so that it's automatically protected against all forms of infectious diseases? But then I also wonder in a classic scientific or in a science fiction level is what's the double edge of the sword? You know, if we're somehow able to prevent all infectious diseases, do we then in turn lose something? Does that create its own problem in some respect? We might, as we evolve in tech, technological development, we might find that viruses and bacteria can be edited as drug delivery, nanobots, for example, and have a valuable potential for some future health use. And so I am hopeful. I'm optimistic, and I'm a believer in the capacity of science and technology to solve our problems. But with any problem that we've solved, new problems always emerge. So
that's an interesting point that you brought up. Instead of fighting against bacteria and viruses, mm-hmm. make use of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's some work being done on that, in terms of cancer treatments using, converted viruses or bacteria. So I think the sky's the limit in that area of technology. And maybe nanobots, maybe a nanobot that can just kill viruses and bacteria is the way to go.
This would be great. And now let me ask you the final question. Mm-hmm. What's your personal goal in the next 10 years? What do you want to achieve?
I think in the next 10 years, I want to be able to say that I helped IVI grow from a sleepy, not really well-known research institute into a globally recognized, frequently called upon international organization that is able to develop and deliver solutions for the world and global health, that will continue to develop more vaccines. Vaccine timelines are long, but maybe we can get another two vaccines out in my time at IVI, and really make a difference in saving people's lives, because that's ultimately the goal. That's why we're here. It's what we're doing it. There's no point that people should be dying of vaccine preventable diseases. There's so much, opportunity. There's so much, human wealth out there in the world that we're losing out. It's the old question of, how many potential Einsteins died as illiterate peasants in a field because they never reached their full opportunity. And how much value could those people deliver to the world? And I see the same thing with vaccines. We can facilitate the arrival of more Einsteins by protecting their health.
That's a great mission. That's a great vision. I love what you say. And from what I learned in the last 3 years is make use of social media, make use of podcasts. It really helps these days to spread your message. Mm-hmm. And you have a fantastic message and a fantastic mission. Thank you for sharing it on my podcast.
Thank you very much, Christian. It's a pleasure, and I'm happy to talk to you anytime in the future.
Colin, thank you for having you today here on the podcast. All the best to you and your team, and mm-hmm. keep on fighting against viruses and bring people together to solve our problems.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to it.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Yeah, have a great
day. Bye. Evening.
Yep. See you. Bye-bye.
So thank you for listening. And as we wrap up today's episode with Colin McCann, we've explored how collaboration and innovative approaches can unlock the potential of our vaccines and global public health. Growing the podcast follower base makes a significant difference as it enables me to attract more distinguished speakers and deliver even more valuable content to you. Your support truly matters in shaping the future of this podcast. So, please don't forget to subscribe to the channel, leave a positive comment, and share this content with those who might benefit from it. Let's spread the knowledge and create a healthier future for all. Thank you for listening to the Beginner's Mind podcast, and see you in the next episode.